are now going. Go ahead, you may begin.
Thank you very much, Sharon. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. This is the 6th of July, the PEDNR call. And on the call, we have Tatia Kramsova, Siva Mutasami, Cheryl Langdonor, Jeffrey Eckhaus, Alan Greenberg, Barry Cobb, Mikey O'Connor, Michele Nilon, James Bladel, Paul Diaz, Ted Suzuki, Mason Cole, and for staff, we have Marika Koenig and myself, Glenda Saint-Jury, and Margie Marlam. Thank you, Alan. Over to you.
Thank you very much. All right. Two major things on our agenda today. The first is to talk about a number of items that came up during the Brussels consultation. The second is to hopefully quickly go through what we're planning to do on the public comment forum survey, or the survey associated with the public comment, so that we can open that up quickly. Marika has put up on the Adobe window the major items that both of us noted may be worthy of some discussion. Is everyone on the call have access to Adobe right now? Or is there anyone who doesn't? Hearing no one speak up, I'll assume everyone does. Marika, do you want to try to walk us through it one by one? If you're not watching the game?
Trying to at the same time, but I'll run you through it. I managed to get a streaming going, so... So basically, the first four points, I think, are the ones that that I noted. Our first two are the points I noted down from the meeting. The first one was a discussion on value of a best practice. I think the question was raised, what value does a best practice has if it doesn't have any conditions linked to it? There was discussion that in certain sectors, if you follow best practices, it might give you immunity, or you have something to say, well, I did all of this, so I'm actually not liable in that case. But in the environment we're talking about, best practices don't have any of that. So that was one of the issues raised and might warrant further discussion, as in certain areas we're looking at whether something should be a policy or a best practice.
Yeah.
And whether maybe there could be certain incentives, I guess, linked to best practices.
The other issue, I think, that comes in addition to safe harbors, which is not the typical case for a best practice, is generally, if one follows a best practice, there's some benefit to one's business other than just being nice to your customers. If you have a Better Business Bureau seal of approval, it's because you follow the rules, and you can display that, and that may put you in a different status compared to your competitors. And there's currently nothing like that in the registrar community, at least nothing that I'm aware of. So I guess I'd like to understand, we use the term best practice, but I'd like to understand what meaning does it have if it's not obvious to a potential customer that you're doing these things that have been recommended and they don't have access to the list, ready access to the list of what the things are, so they can't even compare for themselves. James?
Yeah, Alan, I'm just curious, and I'm clearly don't know the answer to this question, so I'm asking the group, is that statement necessarily true? It may not be particularly applicable to post-expiry, but I think that there are definitely situations, for example, under certain legislation where, web hosts and ISPs and registrars have certain best practices that they should undertake in order to limit or eliminate their liability in certain situations. So I'm not sure that saying that there's no best practices or best practices have no benefit. I'm just not comfortable with that as a blanket statement. It may be true in this particular case, but I don't know if that's always true.
Yeah, certainly the first case that Marika mentioned is the one you just did, that there may be freedom or reduced liabilities if you follow some accepted list of best practices, and that's certainly one of the others. And the other one is the equivalent of a seal of approval, a stamp of approval stamp of something that that may attract customers. And my question was, in the absence of those two, in the types of things we're talking about right now, does the term have much meaning? If we're going to use it in the report, I think we have to understand what does it really mean, as opposed to simply a label that we're inventing. Mikey?
Hi, Alan. This is Mikey. At least for me, neither of those two are what I was thinking of. When I use the term best practice, I'm coming from sort of the manufacturing industry quality sense of the term, and companies, I am absolutely sure that registrars and registries are already exchanging best practices informally amongst themselves, because it's always in a company's best interest to use the best practices in their field to get something done. And the term came out in a couple of other working groups. My mind grows foggy as to which one, but it was either IRTP or RAP where we started talking about it and actually encouraged formalizing what I think is already informally taking place amongst registrars and registries with regard to abuse. And I think that the same could be used here. And in fact, if you wanted to dig into the RAP report, there's probably some language in there that describes what we were talking about. So I'm not sure that I'm comfortable. I guess I'll go with James on this one. I'm not sure that I'm comfortable with those being the only definitions available to us.
Well, I wasn't trying to say they're the only ones. I was trying to understand what the definitions are. Cheryl?
Thank you, Cheryl here. Just following on from what Mikey said, from the perspective of the consumer, and here I'm putting on my consumer advocacy, well-practiced consumer advocacy focus from, yes, I admit, the country, not the globe, with a definition, we would expect that there are a number of best practices that anyone in any particular industry who claims to be a professional and indeed wishes to have success is following. And this ranges from banking and credit card management best practice through to advertising best practice through to all sorts of things. And I think if we're going to make some definitions, we need to recognise that there are a bunch of really smart and sensible things that all successful businesses are indeed or should be doing, and those who are not are simply floating on good luck, probably not good management. What, from my perspective, I was thinking, and when in the terms of PEDNA and in some of the other work groups that some of us are involved in, I'm referring to a best practice model, I'm thinking much more along the lines of a domain name industry code, best practice, set of agreements, aims, objectives, you know, seven people in a room say, yeah, we all agree this is a good idea for minimum standard, that type of thing. Now, that may or may not end up in a recognised mark that consumers can go, oh, look at that, gold star in a red circle, that's a place I can trust.
I guess the question I was asking is, if it does not end up in a mark or something, how does how does the consumer end up being impacted by it, or can make decisions based on it?
Well, I can respond, obviously, only from the experience that I have. And in the case of something as powerful as an industry-based code of conduct, which would be up to industry to develop, there would be teeth in that. The same would be said for any auditable mark. One either does or does not have the right to bear that particular mark, the same as is seen in a number of other aspects, such as the telemarketing or various types of existing codes of practice in a whole lot of other industries.
But you're saying it still has to be espoused by and essentially identified as a best practice by the industry group.
That's one way of doing it.
Yeah. Okay. James?
Yeah, Alan, thanks. James speaking. And, I guess I'm just more inclined to look at methods that are carrots as opposed to sticks. But I feel that, in any industry, the players who are abiding by helping to develop and then implementing best practices in their own businesses will have better PR, they will have a better industry reputation, and they will derive benefits of that in terms of the number of consumers that choose them as their provider. We offer a lot of products that translate into seals of approval or badges or things like that on websites, and while I don't want to diminish the value of having those, I will say that it is a challenge indeed to build awareness in consumers' minds to look for that stamp of approval and to, insist upon it when they're shopping around for their business. Most of them are looking at things like price tags and other things like that. So I just wanted to point out that those who follow best practices enjoy growth and prosperity, and those who don't usually find themselves marginalized. And I know that that's not quite as effective. It's very effective, but it's just not rapid. It doesn't give us that cathartic feeling of really coming down on the bad guys, but it is very real.
Mikey?
This is Mikey again. Just to build on what James was saying and also what Cheryl was saying, I think that what I'm hearing in your commentary, Alan, is that you're not real keen on the idea of best practices. You're basically sort of making gently negative comments about them. And I guess my point here is that I'm not as negative about them as you. I think that, in fact, to your latest point, where you said that they're generally made by the market players, that's not necessarily true. And
James said that, not me.
I'm not going to quibble over who said what, but, my point here is that I think that there is a lot of value in ICANN encouraging and nurturing an exchange of best practices by market players with the involvement of all kinds of people without necessarily dictating what those best practices are, because best practices by their nature will emerge as best practices. That's what that's why I'm sort of stuck on defining it for you, because for me it's one of these fundamental things. It's like the color red. It's very hard for me to define that because it's a best practice.
Just as a comment, I'm not against best practices at all. I just think that they need to be formalized at some level to be effective. Otherwise, there's no easy way of recognizing them or differentiating them, other than if the market works as one expects. Unfortunately,
well, Alan, let me push back a little bit here. A best practice will be effective because it's the best way to do something. It doesn't have to be formalized. It doesn't have to be put on a sticker. It doesn't have to be anything. The best way to do accounting is with debits and credits, and it's a best practice. And you don't have to put a badge on your company saying that you use debits and credits. It's just the best way to do accounting. So you may want to take it one step further, and I think this is where Cheryl is saying that there is another layer to this, which is essentially the branding or badging of adherence to best practices, but the best practices themselves are just the best way to do something.
Alan Sperry, may I get in the queue?
Yeah.
Who was that?
Is it Barry?
Okay, after Ron.
Yes, this is Ron. I have some difficulty with the concept of best practices with some of the activities that's gone on in our group. One of the issues that comes up to me is I keep hearing, I'll refer back to the gentleman from Brazil who felt that his best practices for his customers were different than the best practices would be for other registrars. Or so I don't see how that's where you could say it could come from an industry group, but it has to be an industry group that sees itself with a common mission. And the fellow who from Brazil saw quite a different mission for his customers or his business model than what would be a registrar. So a registrar for bloggers is completely different from his view from a registrar for that deals with commercial domain names. So therefore, how do we combine that into a single best practice? The other aspect that bothers me about the best practice thing is I don't see how our group. So we're going to come up with. Are we going to have a contest to design a logo for a PEDNR best practice? I mean, we certainly can't do a best practice for all of ICANN because our scope is only for PEDNR. So I don't see how best practice in our work output fits with the recognition that could come from a logo.
Barry?
Thank you, Alan. This is Barry. I think I'll try to maybe bridge the divide here. Alan, to your point, I think I understand where you're coming from is what we have today and to what Mikey had mentioned, I believe it was FastFlux and RAP that has put forth recommendations for best practices. What we're absent today is a formal platform by which they truly get disseminated. And up to today, ICANN hasn't stepped up to the plate to do that. And we, you know, the argument of whether they should be the ones to do it or not is, I think, a different debate. Although in many instances, it seems like ICANN would be a good candidate. But so I'd just like to kind of take or circle back to Mikey's example about what goes on within corporations or the industry. And certainly, I've had direct experience within my IT background is. There were centers of competency or centers of excellence that owned the best practices and worked with their industry players or stakeholders to help develop them. And then from there, they are disseminated in a more formal point. So I think kind of to Ron's, you know, point is that, you know, there was more of a credibility behind the message of the best practices that they were deploying. And yes, certainly different stakeholders and market players can choose to adopt those or morph them to what meets their business model, etc. And you know, there is only just a level of adoption. And kind of back to Mikey's point is those that choose to accept it all the way, chances are, tend to prosper better from it. So, again, the recommendation, I'm for recommendations behind best practices. But I do share Alan's concern, and correct me if I misstated it, but we're just missing that formal platform, and that's something that the GNSO, ICANN, and industry participants in the contracted space need to figure out. Somehow we need to find something. Thank you.
Yeah, just to clarify on that, I think that would go a long way. You know, if ICANN or the registrar's constituency or something had such a code of best practice, I think the statements that were made earlier that if you follow what are deemed to be best practices, you succeed. If you don't, you're likely not going to, would question the need for audits in general and we shouldn't have had the financial crisis, and there shouldn't have been melamine-contaminated milk products if everyone followed best practices because it was simply better for them. I think that's a euphoric view of life, which I'm not sure we can take. If there was some sort of codification of them, if they were espoused by some semi-formal group, that changes it completely, I think. James?
Hi, yeah. First off, I was just holding a place for a Barry, but yes, you know, we've compared the registrars to the banks and the folks, you know, producing tainted products. We forgot BP, though. I heard that one a lot.
Sorry, there was no intention to compare.
Want to make sure we get the whole gamut.
I was just pointing out that there's a whole range of activities. You know, no one would have invented keeping double sets of books, to use the accounting analogy, if following best accounting practices was the best way to succeed. So
yeah.
I think it's a view of the world which is a little bit euphoric.
No, I don't think so, Alan. I will say that there are harms that certainly can come in the short term, but I think in the long term, registrars who are in it for the long haul and really do care about their customers really will follow best practices, but that's just, you know, a separate argument. And I think that, you know, we were talking about benefits, not really harms. But I think I wanted to go back real quickly, and I don't want to bog down the conversation, but Ron made a point earlier, and I just wanted to get to the group that just because these forums or platforms for exchanging best practices are not necessarily open to you know, non-registries and registrars doesn't mean that they don't exist. They do exist, and I know this because I'm very active in them. So
okay.
Just wanted to get that out there.
Yeah, we've got a couple more speakers. I'd like to cut off the speaker list and so we can go on to some of the other items, but let's go ahead with those on now. Cheryl?
Hi, Cheryl here, and just a very brief point. Because the At-Large Advisory Committee has surprisingly enough, been very interested in best practices and matters across all sorts of things, including the RIA, and I'm just struggling to find it. I will have staff find where it is being put because pages have been changed on the wiki. We did have copy of the efforts by the industry some, I think, 7 to 9, 11, 9 and 10 years ago, where you all did coalesce together as a group and go a certain way forward in developing an industry code of what we could these days be referring to as best practices. So I will find that archive and I will share it with you all.
Jeff?
Yeah, sorry. I guess we are moving on, but I was still trying to, under the impression of, let's try and figure out what are the, you know, the recommendations and what we want to do, I guess, before we figure out what's the best way to disseminate it. And, you know, discussing, I don't know if we want to go, if we go best practices, or the other piece might be putting the cart before the horse. So maybe I think you said you wanted to cut this off. So to go to the actual issues here and see what are the recommendations, what we'd like to do versus debating each one, because some of them might work with the best practice, some might not, but we need to know what those some things are, what those recommendations may be.
Okay. Just for clarity, the reason I brought it up is I'm sure we're going to end up with some things we recommend as best practice. You know, whether it's for all of them or not is a different issue. And I felt if we're going to recommend best practice or even use the term in the report, we should be able to define it to make sure it's clear to people what we mean by it. And that was the reason I raised it to begin with. Cheryl, your hand up again on this? Cheryl has disappeared. Is she still on the call?
Hi there. Sorry.
Yeah.
We had a total blackout, but it's the power's come back on now, so phones are working. If I don't know how much you heard, but basically I'll find the old archives because we do have copies of them.
We heard
and,
all that.
And that was it. I was going to stop anyway, but someone turned my power off.
It stopped at a very nice pause in the sentence. We thought you were finished.
Yeah, I was finished,
okay.
But, you know. Now I just have to find out
all
why.
All right. The next point, Marika, I'll read it out so you can continue watching the game.
happy to go through it as well.
Okay.
I can do two things at the same time.
Oh, you're marvelous.
She's a woman. She can multitask.
Ooh.
Go for it, Marisa.
Okay. So another point that was discussed was services following expiration. We had a discussion what is actually under control of the registrar and what is under control of the registrar and registrant, and what, if anything, could be affected by policy changes. And it links to the discussion that we had on whether, you know, email should stop or whether the website should stop. And I think part of the discussion that came back there from some is saying, well, you cannot actually identify who controls those different items. So it might make sense to focus on the top level, which, as I understood, was a DNS server that basically would result in switching off everything or leaving things on. So that should be the focus instead of trying to dig too much at different levels where you actually might not be able to identify or predict or guess what is happening.
Yeah, thank you, Marika. Yeah, that conversation, for those of you present, got off, I think, on a wrong twist, because we mentioned the concept of selectively changing services, although in general the group has not advocated it, but somehow we focused on the difficulty and perhaps impossibility of actually doing that, whereas I don't believe there was a strong push from the group to do anything other than turn off everything, and noting that Siva is the dissenter on that for email. There was a hand up which has disappeared. Does anyone want to make a comment of that? I think we ended up having violent agreement on that, although the discussion did go off at a tangent for a while. Not seeing anything, can we go on to the third point?
This is Marika again. The third point relates to, there was a question whether if there would be a recommendation to adopt the RGP as a consensus policy, whether in theory it would be possible to make that only obligatory for registries or registrars, but we checked on that, and basically it's basically the consensus policy could prescribe requirements for registries or registrars or both.
Okay. In the absence of any hands, we'll go on to the next point.
Another issue discussed is whether any cases where an RE cannot request an inter-registrar transfer during the post-expiration period. I think it's an issue we debated several times as well on the calls and on the list.
Yeah, the reason I put that up is we ended up in the meeting having some level of confusion as to whether the changing of who is does matter or not, and to what extent the losing registrar has the ability of putting an impediment in the way of the registrant. And I guess I'm looking for registrars who are on the receiving end. You know, what kind of problems are there in if you receive a request to transfer a registration to you? That do we need to address anything with policy, or are there indeed no problems or no significant problems in if a registrant attempts to transfer a registration to you during the expiration period? Not seeing any hands. Does that help? Two hands. James.
Not sure how to answer this one, Alan, so I'm going to go ahead and shoot from the hip and say that, you know, if the registrant can get their auth info code from their registrar, we would have no problems, I think, getting that name. And I'm going to say that with a qualifier that I should probably look into that a little bit more. But
I mean, certainly there have been cases, if you look at the pre-expiration time, where people cannot transfer domain because their domain is locked by the registrar of record, or, you know, various other terms, or makes it difficult. And in those cases, ICANN seems to have taken the position that they remind the losing registrar that they should not be stopping a transfer for reasons like that. But ICANN compliance has taken the position on post-expiration that they can't do anything about it, and that's what had me somewhat confused. McKaylee?
I'm just agreeing with what James was saying. I mean, the only thing is with a transfer is that you have to get the authorization from the registrant. So if they can get the code and they can get the email, then it should be fine.
And if they can't?
Well, then obviously it's not fine.
Yeah, if they can't, you know, for whatever reason, there's very little that the gaining registrar can do to assist, because that's essentially indistinguishable from an unauthorized transfer.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the problems we have with transfers relate to things like EPP keys being supplied that are invalid, or people forgetting the not providing the correct EPP. In other words, they think that the exclamation mark at the end of an EPP key is just an exclamation mark and they can ignore it, or problems with people using very strange Whois servers formats and things like that. But, I mean, that's the same with any transfer. It's got nothing to do with whether the domain's expired or not.
And am I correct in saying, though, that in the pre-expiration, the normal scenario, that ICANN normally takes the position that the losing registrar is obliged to provide the information and is obliged not to arbitrarily lock the domain so it can't be transferred?
Well, the IRTP policy dictates on which circumstances the losing registrar can deny a transfer. So, I mean, there are a number of reasons why the transfer would be denied, and there are valid reasons for that.
Yes, but I'm not talking about... it can only be denied once the transfer has been requested from the gaining registrar. Because the registrant requested from the gaining registrar, and the request to transfer is between the two registrars. So the question is, what about the scenario where the transfer cannot be initiated?
I don't really understand what you're saying, Alan. I mean, I don't actually understand.
Okay, I'll try to put it in writing, because I think this is a question for compliance, not so much for us. I was trying to understand to what extent there was a known issue.
Well, no, I think you're misunderstanding the mechanics of how transfers work, which is what's causing me confusion. I mean, I could request by EPP, I could attempt to request a transfer of google.com if I wanted. But if the EPP key I supply is incorrect, or if the domain is locked, it's going to fail.
Right.
And obviously, the current registrar can reject the transfer anyway.
The question I was trying to raise was, what if the owner of Google cannot get from the current registrar of record the off code?
Well, then you can't. Then the transfer won't be possible.
That's the point I'm making.
Okay.
Okay. My understanding is compliance has taken that scenario pre-expiration and said and has issued advisories saying that the registrar of record must not do that. Post-expiration, they've said they can't do anything about it. And that was the part that I was trying to explore.
I think in that case, Alan, it might be best to put in an email and maybe ask David to clarify, because I'm not 100% sure what you're asking.
Okay. Sorry, James, were you trying to say something?
Yep, McKaylee summed it up there for me.
Okay. So. Okay, the second question was, we were talking at the meeting about RGP transfers, and it had been stated at one point, and I don't remember by who, that if Whois is changed, then the RGP redemption may not be possible. And the statement that was made, and I think it's definitive, that was made at the end of that meeting, was that someone is doing heavy moving of equipment or something on the line.
Actually, it's not heavy moving of equipment. It's me turning power back on, and there is something happening nearby. So just live with it. When I move to the next room, it'll go away.
Okay. The question was, since the request for an RGP redemption is requested by the registrar, it doesn't matter what the who is says. If they're willing to pass it on to the registry, then it is a good thing, and it will be done. And I just want to make sure that was indeed the case, because earlier we had some statements that RGP redemptions could be inhibited by the fact that WHOIS has been changed along the way. Jeff?
Yeah, no, that's 100% right. It has nothing to do with the WHOIS.
Okay.
So that is correct, what you stated. So the WHOIS has nothing to do with it.
All right. We are 40 minutes into the call, and I think we're finished this section. Marika, can we go on to the survey?
Yes.
Do you have it in some form we can see here? Or?
Yeah, I'll go straight to the questions. It's in two pages, so I'll go straight to the actual content questions. The first page is just, who are you, what is your affiliation, and it just basically states how many questions there are and explains that people need to complete the whole survey in order for their response to get recorded, as you know, that's one of the issues we struggled a bit with at the beginning, or some of the respondents. So it's up now, basically, the questions that the second part of the survey, which contains the questions.
Okay. What I've tried to do different in this one is put preambles in, which will frame the questions well enough, even if people have not been part of this working group and are not overly familiar with the issues. What you're seeing is essentially the survey as I drafted it, heavily modified by James. Most of those changes are still there, and then some minor modification by Marika as she was putting it in a form for the survey to try to make it either more readable or more understandable. So the first section we're talking about, I don't really want to go through this in great detail. I'd like you all to look at it and comment via email if you have specific comments. The first section essentially is talking about the renewal after expiration. Should it be should there be an opportunity? Should there be for what time should it be allowed? And then are we talking about that it should be required by ICANN policy? It should be offered at the registrar's discretion, either a best practice or as a means of differentiating service. And Marika has added in all cases a no strong feelings. The next section is on expiration notices, and again, trying to frame the issue. I did add something here which we haven't discussed, and I think it's true, but I'd like confirmation from the registrars. And that's the issue of there's an expectation from some people that if you send a notice and the email, for instance, no longer exists, that you will get a bounce message and you should be able to do something about it. My perception is these messages are sent out in an automated way, and there may not be a very practical way of handling bounce messages, recognizing them and taking action because of them. Is that a reasonable statement, or is that, in fact, unreasonable? Jeff?
I would say that one is you do not always receive bounce back statements.
No, you... No, what? I understand that.
Let me just finish. And then okay. Two... is that, you know, once you reach, let's say you have, you know, registrars, if you have over, you know, a million or so domains, you know, these are batch jobs where you're doing thousands and thousands, you know, of these a day. So, yeah, going through and saying, hey, this one isn't there and dissecting it, that's just not something feasible if you do get a bounce back.
McKaylee?
I mean, we would have a lot smaller customer base than Jeff would have, and our view would be similar. I mean, if I send out an email to say 20 or 30,000 recipients, one, I'm not going to be guaranteed that all of them that haven't bounced have actually reached somebody. I mean, a common enough thing is where the person will come back to you months later and go, oh, you know, I'd only check that particular email account once every few months. There's no way for us to know that. I mean, all we can do is attempt to send a notification. We've no way of knowing if the notification has actually reached a human being on the other end. And dealing with bounce backs is, well, it just doesn't scale once you've got more than a few hundred clients.
Okay, so to summarize, you're both agreeing that what I've written is accurate and a reasonable statement to put in there. James?
Yeah, and I think probably similarly. But, you know, I'm very concerned with any policy or best practice or any recommendation that goes beyond just the registrar obligation to send a notice. You know, whether it gets bounced back, picked up by a spam filter, ignored, deleted, or forwarded to the wrong person is really starting to get outside of anybody's ability to control on a consistent basis, particularly when they get into large numbers. So I think that, you know, the obligation should be, the line of demarcation should be at sending the notice, not on whether or not it was received and acted upon.
I'm not sure what you're responding to. I was describing what is there in the preamble, describing the scenario which says it is not practical to do anything more, and we should not expect registrars to do any more. So I don't think anyone has suggested that you somehow use your crystal ball or anything else to determine whether the message was received.
Then I guess if that is what the preamble is saying, then I agree with you.
Well, it says if these addresses are no longer valid or in use by the registrant, the notices will not be received. These messages are typically sent in large quantities, and detecting bounce messages is often impractical. McKaylee?
Well, I mean, given the fact that it's one that all we're really talking about is sending it, then maybe just remove the preamble. I mean, it's just going to cause more confusion, I suppose, because I mean, it's already managed to confuse a couple of us. And we're eating and breathing this. So maybe just remove it completely. I mean, we're just talking about sending it, and that's it.
But I think the issue is to frame the question saying this is all we're asking about. Because otherwise, I don't want to start getting additional comments back saying that registrars should do things like that, which are not practical.
Alan, the reality is if you send somebody any kind of questionnaire where the question is longer than one or two sentences, people are probably going to pick up on keywords within that and misunderstand what you're asking about. So I think it's just causing more confusion than it's actually solving.
Okay, Mikey?
I was going to say kind of the same thing. I was going to say at least take off that last sentence. I don't think the...
All right. I thought adding it helped make sure that we're not setting expectations incorrectly. But if you want to, everyone wants it to go away, we can make it go away. I thought I had my most defend the registrar hat on, and when I added that. All right, let's go ahead. There's a number of questions about notices. How many? Asking people. There is also a question asking if people, you know, essentially, I think this one came from James, asking people what they believe would be the best way to notify registrants. Mikey, are your hands still up?
Mikey's lost in some weird tech thing that happened on his computer. Sorry about that.
Okay. McKaylee?
You just, Alan, just, look, you keep on referring to the RAA. I mean, I think if you were to refer to, you know, ICANN policy, it might be better.
Fine. I think it was, well, I'm not sure who added the words RAA. Marika, if we can make a note to remove the references to RAA and make it refer to ICANN policy instead, that's fine with me.
Okay.
And apart from anything else,
be more understandable by humans as well.
Yeah, well, two things. One, it'll probably be more understandable by humans. And two, if you keep talking about changing the RAA,
I'm going to say no to everything. And I probably wouldn't be the only registrar who would do that. But as you say something about ICANN policy, I'm much more likely to be reasonable about it.
Fine, the intent of whoever put it in meant sure we have a consensus policy which becomes part of the RAA. But I have no problem at all saying ICANN policy. I think it's clear. So no argument, Jeff.
Yeah. So this is an issue I think I've had and for a while on the notices. Because, you know, there's a lot of things in here that say, should they specify? And it's sort of, I won't say leading, but it's sort of saying, hey, maybe they should send 4 or maybe 5 or something along those lines. And I think on some of these, people might have the feeling that, hey, of course, more is better. But we actually have no idea if it is. Maybe 2 is the optimal number. What if 5 there is, we say, we think we're doing something right for, you know, registrants for these, you know, for these issues, and suddenly there's more confusion because they're saying, hey, I got 5 of them. I didn't know if these were real. I thought it might have been spam. You know, I don't know what's going on. I think that we have to be very careful, and I mean, I don't like this whole section because I don't think that, you know, there's definitely unintended consequences here, and we don't know, and I think the way the questions are written, it's sort of leading to say, oh, of course, more will be better, but we don't know what that optimal number would be. I think allowing, you know, a lot of the registrars have experimented and said, okay, they're, for their base and what they've seen, they know what the optimal number is. And, of course, that's their, you know, it's part of, you know, their secret sauce. But I think to mandate it might not, you know, might not work for every registrar, and we have to realize there's a lot of different countries, a lot of different customer bases, and, you know, a registrar who's in China might say, you know, I need to remind my customers 10 is the best number, while a registrar in Brazil might say 2 is the perfect number for me. And for us to mandate that could not work and doesn't take into account, you know, cultural differences, the customer base, and how it works. So this section I really have a problem with, and I think that it might be actually causing more harm than it is good.
I guess I'll point out that we're not simply going to take the results of the survey and put it in policy, but we're simply asking what people's opinions
are.
Yeah,
that's good to say. I mean, yeah, you could say that because if somebody says, hey, what's the best way to deliver notices, and if somebody says by, you know, somebody dressed up in a suit of armor and a stagecoach, you know, of course, we're not going to put that down because that will never happen. But I think on some of the others, we might say, hey, everyone says 5 is the best. We should include that as a policy. So I think that saying we're not going to do that, it's, you know, it's a noble thing to say up front. But then I don't know what's the purpose of asking this question then. I really have a problem with this one because of, I think, the issues it causes. But I'll leave it at that.
Ron?
Yeah, this is Ron. I'll say a slightly different concern is to say that a registrar in China understands his own customers who are local flies in the face of them advertising to do a top-level domain registration for anyone in the world. So making local policy may make sense for customers in China, but doesn't make sense for a registrar in China or any other single country who undertakes the business of selling domains throughout the entire world.
Any other comments on this section or any section for that matter? Okay, if we can go along, the next part was services after expiration, and essentially that's the question, should we make everything dark or not? Marika, there was a question about education. Do you remember where we ended up putting that one?
This is Marika. Let me just...
James had suggested a sort of an open-ended question of how do we best educate.
Yeah, I think it's just It's just above the services after expiration. I call it information and education, and it has the two open questions. It's just it starts at the bottom of page 4 and then goes into page 5, I believe.
Okay. I see. Okay. There's an orphan title with a small font that I missed. Got it. Okay. There's the after the services after expiration. There's who is, which is the general question of should we fix who is, and certainly among us there was a general unanimity on it. Education and information is the general question that James had suggested of what's the most effective way of alerting registrants. That is an open-ended question saying there is a problem among some registrants. Do you have any ideas? And clearly we're not going to necessarily implement everything people suggested, but we may get some interesting insights. James?
Hi, Alan. James speaking. And I just wanted to point out for the group and for the other registrars who are probably wondering where my head was at, that, you know, I was just trying to introduce the concept of open-ended, free-form questions into the survey to ensure that we, A, weren't leading folks down one path or another, and, B, because, you know, there's always that possibility that the community will come up with something that has been right there in front of our noses, but because we've been working on this for a while, we're too close to the issue to see it. So, you know, I really thought that free-form, open-ended questions were a way to achieve those two goals.
Marika?
Yeah, it is, Marika. Just to add as well, because as I understand, and I already started working on the announcement for it, that the idea would be that either people can opt to fill this in and or submit comments like they usually can, you know, in an email form, you know, whatever they want to write, basically, so that people have different options they can choose from or, you know, do all the different ones they can do. So, so hopefully, indeed, in addition to the additional comment boxes we've left here, you know, people shouldn't feel restrained to add other things that are maybe not covered in the survey as part of the public comment period.
Thank you. Just in response to James, I thought it was a great idea. You know, every once in a while, people do have good ideas, and I think we should be open to them. All right, services after expiration we talked about, and then the RGP. I originally had a single question saying, should it be required for both registries and registrars? And James suggested break it into two questions, which we have done.
Sorry, Alan, can you just repeat the end of that sentence? You faded, at least for me.
Oh, sorry. The original question I had should the RGP be a consensus policy for both registries and registrars? And the James suggested breaking it into two different questions, that is for registries and a separate question for registrars.
Okay, thank you.
And I believe the last section... Hello? I believe the last section is on... comes back to the question of clarity and should there be some information other than the legal contract in, you know, in legal terminology that the registrant has access to. And that's about the size of it. If there are any other comments, I guess this is a good time. Otherwise, Marika and I will do a rework based on our discussion today and try to get it out as soon as possible. Marika, did you check whether the comment period must be 20 days or whether we have the option of making it longer? That was one of the questions that came out of the meeting.
I think the recommendation was to have it as 20 days, but if you really see towards the end that, you know, we have very few comments or we are aware that, you know, certain groups are still working on their comments, I think at that point there's a possibility to extend it.
Okay.
But to follow the bylaws maybe as to start off, I think the recommendation is to do it for 20 days
okay.
with, you know, the possibility to extend it.
Okay. You had your hand up before I asked you the question, so...
Yeah, my question was whether we want to set a deadline for when people can provide comments on the survey so we can actually have a date for launching the public comment period. And just conscious that we're moving closer to August and for many, I think, in Europe, that's typical holiday season.
My inclination is to say no later than the end of this week, but...
And if there are no comments, everyone's happy to that we open it coming Monday. Would that work?
That would work for me. Okay. Then, to quote Star... No, I won't try to quote Star Trek. All right, the last item is the next meeting. I am away all of next week, so my preference is to not hold a meeting next week. But schedule it for the Tuesday afterwards. If there's any objection or someone really wants to hold a meeting, then you can certainly go on without me. But my inclination is to skip a week and schedule it for 2 weeks. Do we have any objection? Marika has her hand up. That may be from before.
Yeah, I'm just taking it down.
I hear no objection. I see no tick marks, but I assume you're all focusing on the game if it's still playing.
Hey, I'm not.
Top
okay.
time. We're paying all of...
We have several questions. We have several questions. We have several tick marks. Then I will thank you for your attention, and Michele says it's halftime, so you're going to get the full last half of the game in uninterrupted then. if there's no other objection, I would thank you for your presence, and this is a lot of presence in the week right out, a very quiet week for teleconferences otherwise, and I will see you all in a few weeks.
Thanks, Alan. And sorry for all my background noise. Restarting a house is always noisy.
And Michele Nalan is now entering the call.
Alan Greenberg is exiting the call. Bye, all.
Bye, all.
Bye.